Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt with a scratchy throat today, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm very happy to have as my guest Rachel Kosk. She has published 2/3 of a trilogy. The books are called Outline and Transit, and they are unusual books in that the typical things that happen in novels, in which people are introduced to you and described and set in motion and put into conflict with one another, are not particularly what these novels have it at heart to do. Why is that?
I suppose I felt that I mean, my process involves finding a form. Finding a form is 90% of of my conception of anything. And that form has to express a phase of life. And I suppose the phase of life that I had in my sights this time would require an anti-form. In a sense, everything that underpins, you know, the novel as an entity would have to be absent to accurately describe the things that I wanted to describe. So sort of grappling with that and formulating with that and thinking, is it possible, was a sort of huge part of coming up with the first two books, and doubtlessly the third one will be the same.
The book is narrated by a woman named Faye, and she's only named once in each of the two books. She's a writer. She has undergone the breakup of a marriage. She's in the most recent book, Transit. She's taken a leap. She's moved to a house in London. She can't afford a house, but she's told better to get a bad house in a good part of London than a good house in a bad part of London. And so she undergoes the meetings with builders and redecorators, all of whom have stories to tell her. She doesn't tell much about herself. What is it about her that makes people want to confide in her?
Perhaps she asks the right questions. The books work through a decision, which is my decision, to write a text in which there is no prior knowledge, because the narrative of prior knowledge seems to me, you know, the very center of what is, if not fake, then at least Victorian or quasi-Victorian. And it's lived on in the novel amazingly through, you know, all attempts to radicalize or make it contemporary.
The characters seem to have stories to tell, especially the students, the writing students. It's an unusual subject. Not many times have writing workshops appeared in novels. And the students have stories to tell, and their teacher, who in the first volume has gone to Athens to teach students who don't necessarily write in English. In the second volume, she meets with other students, and she listens, basically, to their stories, and she seems, in a way, to be like a psychoanalyst.
She's an occasion for people, to humans, to exercise what I believe they possess, which is an innate grasp of form, the form of their own lives, and an impulse to make a story out of it, which, you know, how that sits in reality, with reality, how it interrelates with reality is the question. And that's all she's doing. And this thing is called writing. This this impulse, this innate grasp of form is called writing, but in fact it's talking. The person who writes is her, and she never says anything.
Well, in the last chapter, there's a rather large dinner party, and we meet a group of people simultaneously, all of whom know her, and they seem to have advice for her that they're not sure whether they should give. And so instead of advising her, they tell her their stories. And I have the feeling that this is sort of a commentary on life. You know, it's become very popular to say we can't live without our stories. But it seems, well, yes, we can. We have to. Not everyone wants to hear them. And in this particular case, there's a narrator of a novel. She doesn't tell us anything about her novels. What does this no prior knowledge do for you?
Well, I think that in a situation of, call it trauma, loss, extreme loss of identity, or of what you've come to call reality, because that was what you were conditioned to think of as reality. I mean, it's the sort of classic Jungian predicament that at a certain point, you know, the solidity of that concept, reality, is threatened. And I'm interested in a world after that, in how things look after that. And, you know, your point about the final chapter of Transit, of the you know, the gathering of these people who tell, you know, are really trading in their realities and sort of setting out their stall. You know, those stories endanger people who have no story, and in this case it's children. That really what Transit is about is cruelty, how people inadvertently are cruel to children by alluding to or continuing to inhabit a world of rules that they have, you know, where have these rules come from?
One of her children calls. He doesn't know where he is. He's been walking to school, and apparently he's walked past the school, because she asks him, "Where are you?" And he recites the names of the streets, and she walks him back to the school and tells him on his way home that he can call again and ask her to direct him. I remember myself how terrifying it was to be lost as a child. And it's almost as if the child's trauma is greater than his mother's. Because now, who is your mother when the marriage is over? And how can she answer your questions? And where is she when you call her? I mean, we all have cell phones now. You're not calling home anymore. You may be calling a restaurant or a party or something far more intimate. And so it seems as if she realizes that the child is in a situation of jeopardy, and she puts down everything for him while knowing that she can't really save him or satisfy him.
You've understood very thoroughly an absolutely key part of these two books. That feeling of, you know, what is love, I suppose that's the question. You know, is love something that is you know, familial love, for instance, mother and child love, does it need a story around it? Does it need an institution around it? When you take away those things, when nothing is supporting those identities, she's trying to tell her child the truth. She's trying to live truthfully and allow him to live truthfully. And, you know, where they're suffering, I mean, the question that I think these books are sort of leading to is this idea that there's a value to suffering and that you attain honour in the end by this hard route. And her children are always saying, why is our life not like other people's? You know, why are we always chaotic? Why don't we have normality and stability? And you know, they are people in transition all the time. And her attempts to build a home, you know, that's sort of where we get to in book two. She's trying to actually create a place for them, but it's racked with all these same difficulties and menaced by everything that menaces you when you're not in the secure institution of marriage. So the question of what all of this, whether wisdom is the end of these sufferings for children and for adults, that, you know, that to me is at the heart of it.
I'm talking to Rachel Kosk about her new novel, Transit. It's the second volume of a trilogy. They can be read apart, but I had the feeling that I was getting to know Faye a little bit better in the second book, and that there was a desire to explore the possibility of knowing her, but not very far. And it interests me because this really is the opposite of what a novel wants to do. A novel wants to introduce you and then go deeper and then go deeper and then go deeper. It seems as if you've written three volumes of autobiography and it's as if you've said enough depth. I've provided it already. It has done me no good. You all know what I think. Let me show you what I don't think or how I don't think. How do you write this way?
Writing as a technique ought to work by the rule, not the exception. And actually, a character in a novel who you get to know and they become the cause or center or occasion for you know, this whatever whole sort of theory of life the novel advances, you know, that is an exception. An individual is an exception. So the more visible she becomes, the less interesting, you know, the less need there is to write about her. She's returning back in this book anyway, making herself visible and returning to this, you know, a story of life. The interesting thing, I mean, asking how it gets written, that once you actually make that decision to turn the process inside out, not to know anything, for her not to know anything, for there only to be, I mean, I wrote the books with the aim that more or less anyone walking past would see the same things as the book sees, that there's nothing that the book knows that a passerby wouldn't know just by looking or listening. Or and once you have that aim, it is incredible how many sentences that you would normally write in a novel can't be written. 49 out of 50, I'd say. You try and they don't fit. So in a sense, it writes itself because writing is a technique. And if you make, you know, put a stricture on yourself, then it's very clear what, you know, what you can and can't do.
Are you in collaboration with Faye?
No, I have to try hard not to be. No, the text has to serve the surface, the seen surface of another person, and quite who sees it, you know, that's a tricky question. And some initial sort of versions of outline had her much more as a critic of that surface and an interpreter of that surface. And I find myself getting less interested in that as things go on.
Yes. I found the books fascinating in their simultaneous accessibility and remoteness. Often as not, an experimental novel, take the French New Wave novels, make very great demands on you, demand that you furrow your brow and figure out what this great glut of fact is being doled out to you for. Here, it's a very pleasant thing to go to London to meet an ex-boyfriend on the street. He's never moved. He stayed together with the same woman. He has a child with him. She doesn't carry her children with her. The ammunition of self-presentation is being disparaged in this book to great and, I would say, amusing effect.
So eliminating dread from the prose is an app, and every time I forget to do it, I feel the book start to veer off the road.
Eliminating dread from the prose.
So I think dread is a massive component of narrative, and it's the thing that I've suffered from, I suppose. I've never understood, I suppose, because for me it's the place where living and writing and reading become very interwoven, and to make the book lightsome, to make it free of dread, to have it go up rather than down, and the sentences go up at the end, not down. That was a really absolutely crucial kind of moral, because this is a different morality. It's not a sort of Judeo-Christian morality. I'm trying to get to something else. And that feeling of I suppose you could call it suspense, you know, people can read my book and complain, you know, that there is no plot. But for me, at this point, plot has become the engine of dread, the absolute vehicle and engine of dread.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Rachel Kosk about her book Transit, the second book in a trilogy that began with Outline. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Rachel Kosk about her latest book, Transit, the second novel of a trilogy that explores what it means to truly grasp the life you find yourself in. I also dislike suspense. You know, people love to read thrillers. I can't stand them. They won't let you go to sleep. You have to read the next chapter because you have to find out what happens. And it interests me that you associate this with a Judeo-Christian tradition.
Well, it's about upbringing. It's the thing that as children, you're forced to harden yourself in order to not be a child anymore. And I relate suspense very much to that hardening process. I mean, if you take a true child, they hate it. They hate the idea of being led along into fear or uncertainty. It's almost like a sort of awful test, a hardening up. And I suppose part of what I dearly wanted was to free myself from it and to return to a prose where there was no danger ever. And there might be nothingness, there might just be nothing. You know, that suspense comes out of belief. And if you don't believe in anything, then suddenly you're in a very, very different world.
Is this your case now? Do you not believe in anything?
Oh, I don't think it matters what I think or don't think or believe or don't believe.
Well, of course it doesn't, but of course it does.
Well, but I'm trying to make a created object that expresses something going on or something that I feel in that is new in human experience. And I mean, possibly, you know, I experience things much as everybody else does, but I don't see that experience as special.
I suppose what I'm asking really is, how far do you think you can take this, you know, into the realm of the nothing? It's a fascinating concept, and it's so...
Well, you can't, because things keep coming back, and there are so many obligations that, you know, if you want to tell the truth, obligations keep creating themselves. And we've got, you know, here they all are again with, you know, what's happening politically in this country. You can't disappear or fall silent, or you keep being hauled back
into the communal conversation.
Yeah.
Well, now, in each book, there's a character who misspeaks. In the first book, it's a Greek who says solicitude when he means solitude. And in the second book, it's a Polish builder who says homestruck when he means homesick. And I found the effect, because the books have eliminated so many gestures from their content, I found the repetition of the mistaken word, a crucial mistaken word, to be fascinating. All that's left is a kind of truth that you blunder on by mistake.
Mm. Well, I mean, also the important thing about those mistakes is that Faye corrects them. that really is almost the only thing she does in terms of interfering in what people say. She says, no, you don't mean that, you mean this. Here's the word you're looking for. And so that's really what she boils down to in the end is exactitude and, well, truth. that for her, the choice of, you know, to say what you mean, to get it right, it still matters.
Wow. So when you're working in this way, do you feel frightened moment by moment?
Yes.
It would seem to require that, because you're really working out a kind of, you said moving up, the sentences move up, but you're really working on a kind of high wire act.
Yeah, well, it would be the fear of the high wire person, which I think isn't fear, it's freedom. But you have to know how to do it. And freedom is technique. It's knowing how to do a thing. So it's when you don't know how to do it that it becomes frightening. And if I ever forget how to do it, then I'm frightened.
But technique keeps coming up. Where did you learn your technique?
I think I'm not sure whether D.H. Lawrence ever actually sort of wrote this down anywhere, but I have the impression that he did, his belief that you could gain complete knowledge of, you know, universal knowledge by studying one thing in infinite detail, and that thing might be a leaf, or you know, that you could learn everything simply by knowing one thing very, very thoroughly. And I think I would subscribe to that. And I know quite a lot about his life, and I know how rarely, if at all, his experience took him into the places his writing takes him into. So he would so seem to prove, you know, I mean, I believe that people are very... and that morality is a tool of blindfolding and concealment, and you know, that you think someone else is a murderer and that you could never do that. And you know what Lawrence says is everything can be understood and identified with. Everything, if you're sufficiently honest with yourself, you fully understand even the most gruesome act that another person, you know. And that's how he does it. That's how he knows what a woman feels like in labor, for instance, which he, you know, his descriptions of that are extraordinary. So I suppose that's the process that I've been interested in, is complete honesty, getting you somewhere technically. I believe those two things are, in what I do and in a lot of creative work, absolutely inseparable.
I've been talking with Rachel Kosk, author of Transit. It's the second book of a trilogy that began with Outline. The books are published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. Thank you, Rachel, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from Transit at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes, or you can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer, co-producer today. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she's a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Alvaro Enrique is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.